Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, January 11, 2007. And first of all, I want to thank everybody, the 56 people who ordered, actually a few less than 56, because some people ordered more than one, of the two-book special that was the first printing of the weather book that we found a box of 56 of those books. And then also combined with that, the new release of the new book that's coming out in a couple of weeks. So thank everybody that did order that. And for those who did not have the opportunity to order the pre-release, and by the way, those people will not see the book any sooner than anybody else. It's just that these books tend to sell out the first night. Whatever printing we do, we seem to always run short. And so these people will be guaranteed the first copies off the printing press, and they'll be mailed out right away, also signed. So thank everybody that did help with the production of this book. And of course, as you know, I produce all of these myself. I am the publishing house also, so it's the only way I work. I work by myself. And so at any rate, thanks once again to those people who helped make this next book a little bit easier on me in the production side of it. And that's where the help came in. So onwards, the science topic for tonight's show will be a term that is rarely remembered in science today. Unfortunately, there's too many high-powered scientists running around seemingly willy-nilly doing things, and the term is repeatability. Very simple, but very subtle, very important term I will be talking about tonight on tonight's show, the main science topic. But first, just an aside note for people on the shortwave, listening on shortwave, many of them do not have computers, so grab a paper and a pencil. Just quickly give you some information, and I would recommend, if you can, if you have a friend that has a computer or a local library, you could go in and quick log into my webpage. You could listen to the past archives of the radio shows. There's a lot on the webpage that you know, is worth going there. About 2.7 gigabytes of information on my website, so quite a bit of information, including the many years of archive shows. That is, the web address is jmccsci.com. That's seven letters, jmccsci.com. The full web page is jmccannyscience.com, but it's too difficult to spell to get it correctly. So I have an abbreviated form, jmccsci.com. And the 800 number is simply for the introductory set of books, an offer, and then also the Berkey water filter. And that number is 800-983-5622. So I'm going to go right into the science topic for tonight. Repeatability, and this is such a huge topic, I cannot overstated the way I'm going to talk about this is, first of all, in my own research over the decades from the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and into this new century, 2000, and the first decade of the first century, which we are now in year seven, if you can believe that. Where has this decade gone? It's flying by. But at any rate, as I've done my research, I have always kept something in mind. As I say, it's been lost in the world of standard science. That is repeatability. And you're going to find that this comes into play in the macroscopic world, in the cosmos, the largest scale, the theoretical work dealing with the largest scale objects in the universe, the galaxies and galactic structures and groups of galaxies. And it also is in the intermediate zones of solar systems and planets, and it comes down to the biological level where we have DNA and groups, repeating groups of molecular structures. Very important. Repeatability. Is the DNA on this side of the universe the same as the DNA on the other side of the universe? Is a diamond on this side of the universe the same as a diamond on the other side of the universe? And the answer is a very simple yes. That these structures are universal. So when people study science, especially a lot of the high-powered, say, astrophysical theories, dark matter, dark energy, even if they do discover such a thing, does it really solve the problems that they claim that it would solve? And the answer is a very simple no. So I'll get into that. The other side of this, not just to critique standard science, but the universe is very simple. And I feel far too many times that in the effort to make complexity for complexity's sake, science has lost sight of the very simple, of the structures in the universe that are essential to our own existence. And that quality of repeatability, of symmetry, those very simple properties that express themselves in nature repeatedly. And as I say, whether you look at a galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy, which is our next nearest neighbor, or whether you look at a galaxy which is across the farthest span of the universe, they are the same. There are certain properties, symmetry, simplicity, repeatability. Why are these structures repeating themselves, and why are the theories that come out of standard science not including this concept of repeatability? Let's go to some very fundamental physics experiments, like the experiment to determine the electric charge on an electron. Let's talk about that would be the Coulomb experiment. Let's talk about the fundamental properties of light, like the speed of light. Measuring it here, whether I measure it here or someone measures it in Russia, or whether they are in Greece or Malaysia or China or Pakistan, the end result, if the experiments are done properly, would be to get the same result. But also, when I learned physics, when I studied, we had to not only build and design our own experiments and physically build them, cut the wires, put in the power supplies. We had a machinist on duty who would make physical parts. Not only did we have to perform the experiments and get results, we had to know the accuracy of the results and why the accuracy, the margin of error, that is, why the margin of error was a certain value. We had to actually calculate those margins of errors, and that's very important in science, because when the next person comes along trying to, say, refine the value of the charge on an electron or improve the value of the speed of light, and they look at previous experiments and they go, well, this was the end result, but it was accurate plus or minus such and such a value, then they would, of course, want to improve on that. And repeatability, in other words, they would have to look at what previous experiments performed and then improve on that. and also calculate their limits of experimental value so that the next person along might improve on that. A value without limits or experimental limits or margins of error calculated and understood, just a value of the speed of light or the charge on an electron, has very little value because you don't know how accurate it is within, you know, plus and minus some small value, some percentage of the total number that you're looking at. And this comes back to the topic of repeatability. If I do an experiment and someone else builds it exactly the same way in another country, can they reproduce the results within that same set of experimental error values? Is it repeatable? So once again, you look at the what we are studying in physics or biology or chemistry or astrophysics or cosmology or subatomic physics, repeatability is an essential ingredient in science. And as I said, too many times repeatability is lost. Now, let's take, for example, let's go back to Galileo when he stood on the Leaning Tower of Pisa with his students watching and a group of professors watching who had been teaching Aristotelian physics, which claimed that the larger ball would fall faster than the smaller ball. That was Aristotelian physics, and which also taught concepts, for example, that an object set in motion would come to rest all by itself. They did not understand friction. But at any rate, Galileo standing up on the Leaning Tower of Pisa with a large iron ball in one hand and a smaller iron ball in the other hand lets them drop, and they both hit the ground at the same time. The professors that were looking at this turned around, walked away angrily, and kept teaching their incorrect physics. Not just for a little while, but for hundreds of years to come in some cases. So the point is that, excuse me, science has to be repeatable, and repeatability has to be an essential ingredient to any theoretical construct. And so this brings us up to, let's talk about galaxies first, and I'll talk about the big things, the cosmological structures, and then work all the way down to the subatomic world, and then branch it back all the way out to the cosmos again. Starting out with galaxies, there is a concept that's been around for many decades, and when I was at Cornell back in the late 70s, early 80s, this idea of density waves forming a galactic arm structure and dark matter, that invisible magical matter that scientists need to make standard theories work. And oddly enough, you need so much dark matter in many cases that it's more mass than the nucleus of the galaxy. In other words, this invisible dark matter, there has to be so much of it to make this density wave theory work that there's more matter orbiting the nucleus than in the nucleus itself, which is obviously a very strange celestial configuration, something that would not work on a repeatable basis throughout the universe. So at any rate, back to the repeatable nature of galaxies. Now, you can go on the internet and look at hundreds, if not thousands, of pictures of spiral galaxies, beautiful spiral arms, and many times people think that the spiral arms are all in one plane, like a big dish, like a big flat dish. But in fact, there are many oddities in galaxies. They can be warped. In other words, it's like a warped record disk or a warped plate. But the interesting thing about the warpage in the galactic plane is that the arm over on this side is warped exactly the opposite, in an asymmetrical mode from the arm on the other side of the galaxies. So asymmetries come up in physical structures, something that is very interesting. So Let's talk a little bit about this concept of a density wave forming a galactic arm. Now, I'm going to talk about what I believe is the correct answer later, but I'm going to first talk about what I truly see as the incorrect solution, which is being passed around as the correct solution today in standard astrophysics. It's called the density wave theory, and it may have different names, it may have different cloaks today. But essentially, to get those spiral arms moving around the galactic nucleus, you start out with a cloud of dust and gases, and something comes by and magically sets a gravitational wave out into the galactic structure and causes the density wave, in other words, density of matter wave, to start traveling in a circular pattern around the nucleus. The only problem is that does not explain the tremendous symmetry that you see in galaxies. Now, if you go to the internet and you look at pictures, or you look in an astronomy textbook or whatever at galactic pictures, you will find that take the nucleus and take the spiral arms and measure with a ruler or a piece of graph paper or whatever certain areas in the spiral arms, whether they're star clusters or voids where there are no stars, you will find that the voids or the star clusters or whatever on one side of the galaxy are, and then go directly through the galaxy the same distance on the other side, you will find tremendous, tremendous symmetry in these galactic structures. So how on Earth or in the universe could you take a random event such as a big object passing by one of these, say, forming galaxies, induce a gravitational wave that causes these incredible symmetries to form in the arms being hundreds of thousands of light years apart. Now, that's very interesting for a random passage of an object. Now, someone might say, well, I can simulate it and show you how it's done. And indeed, you could find some configuration of an object approaching a galaxy or whatever to induce some type of a gravitational wave that might give you symmetry in one galaxy. But how could this be repeatable across billions and billions of galaxies throughout the universe, on the far end of the universe, and all the way up to our closest neighbor, the Andromeda Galaxy, which is right next door? So that's the problem. The problem is not that you couldn't find one example. The problem is repeatability across the universe. And so now people are looking for dark matter and dark energy to solve their cosmological deficiencies in their theoretical work. And some people claim to have actually seen dark energy and dark matter. But usually it's in the side effects. They don't really see it directly. They see it in secondary or third order measurements that are being made, and they interpret it as meaning that there's dark matter there or dark energy in a certain location. But once again, the problem is, even, let's play devil's advocate, even if you did observe, even if you did observe dark matter or dark energy, how on Earth does it become distributed so perfectly symmetrical around this galactic structure to do what it has to do? And there again, one might imagine a way that it could happen one time, but billions of times over and over again throughout the universe at random in these galactic structures, it doesn't meet the test of repeatability, which is a fundamental property of all scientific endeavors, of theories, of experimentation, of measurements, etc. So now I'm going to talk about what I believe is the absolutely true method where galaxies form, where the arms form, and the very simple explanation of how these star densities occur with great symmetry. the matter coalesces, falls into the galactic nucleus. I have a paper on this published in the Astrophysics Journal. You can get references to this on my, I believe this is in the, yes, in the Appendix 1 of the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. You would find a reprint courtesy of the publishing house, and this was published in a journal called Astrophysics and Space Science. I believe 1979 or 1980 is the publication date of this short paper on galactic evolution. The point is, however, that with the matter coalescing around the nucleus and then being emitted out in two spraying arms that come out of the central region of the nucleus of the galaxy, that explains the star densities. That explains why there are voids on one side of the galaxy and a void on the other side of the galaxy, because these arms formed and were generated in the vicinity, in the localized vicinity of the same nucleus and at the same time. So there's a reason why every galaxy across the universe has symmetrical arms. There's a reason why the warp disks are asymmetrical, where an arm will go up on one side and the symmetrical arm will go down on the other side. There's an asymmetry there. Whereas if you look at perpendicular to the plane of the galaxy, once again, the star densities on one side of the galaxy match the other one. But that is, once again, easily explained by the concept that the galactic arms are coming out on opposite sides of the nucleus, based on the amount of matter and material that was in the nucleus region at the time when that star system formed and was thrown out of the galactic nucleus region. The whole paper talks about this. It's a fluid flow problem, and for the average listener, this may be getting a little deep and a little bit far-fetched, but you all know what a galaxy looks like, that beautiful spiral galaxy shape. The point is repeatability, and that's a topic that anybody can understand. Let's talk about solar system development, the development of the planets and the sun. Now, there are obviously solar systems all around the universe. Scientists are beginning to discover them. And I remember it probably wasn't even 10 years ago and people were going, gee, could we be the only solar system in the universe? Could we be the only planet that is a water planet, because it's the only real water planet in our solar system? Mars obviously was a water planet at one time, because it has all of the characteristics, rivers, ocean beds, etc., but really doesn't have any water to speak of today, maybe just minor traces of water. But the point is, how could scientists sit here and look at Earth and our solar system and wonder, gee, is this the only one that exists? And the answer to me is so obvious, well, of course not. It would be like picking up a diamond, they're coming up out of the ground and saying, gee, it's the only one I can see. Is this the only diamond in the universe? Is this the only diamond on Earth? Because that's the only one you can see. I would think that the concept would be, you pick up a diamond and you go, gee, I found this here. These must be all over the planet in different locations, where they form due to whatever process would form a diamond, but also these are common throughout the universe, or a crystal, or water, or planets with water, or anything else that we see here, including life, including animals, including birds. Maybe they won't look exactly like the birds on planet Earth, but somewhere out there, there's a planet, probably many of them, probably billions of them, with similar characteristics. And that gets us down to the very fundamental building blocks of life. DNA and the amino acid chains that build the DNA. And then something even more fundamental. If I have DNA in one side of my body over in my thumb, And there's the same DNA in the left side of my body, in my thumb over here, and in every other part of my body. Well, then, why would anybody doubt the fact that there could be similar DNA molecules on the other side of the universe? That leap of logic seems to escape standard science. Once again, you use the simple concept of repeatability. If I have it here, and I have, you know, billions of DNA strings in my body, then how come scientists wonder, could there be any DNA any place else in the world, or in the universe, I mean, or in a distant star system? The concept is so, it boggles my mind to think that scientists, until they can see it, they won't believe that repeatability, just the simple concept of repeatability, would tell you there's something more to these carbon and other atoms that build these chains, that build up the amino acids, that build up the DNA molecules. There's more to it than just something that happened here on planet Earth. There's something fundamentally, repeatably consistent throughout this planet and the rest of the universe. So on the very farthest side of the universe, there will be diamonds, there will be crystals, and there will be DNA-like structures. Very simple. And when you start looking, now I do have to give credit to biologists, because they do understand the concept of repeatability, and they are breaking down the fundamental building blocks of biological life. And I want to insert here a conversation I had with a talk show host who is a professed atheist. And it went something like this. Of course, I am a person who believes that the design of the universe transcends what we call religion. You know, whether it's the Christian or Lutheran religion, or the Catholicism or Islam or any of the other sects that might be around the world, something universal transcends all of this, and it's the ability of intelligent man to look around him and say, you know, there's some design here, there's something above us that we don't really know about, because we're just kind of like, we're like intelligent creatures crawling around this planet, but there's something more to this universe, this amazingly consistent, repeatable universe, than meets the eye. So anyway, back to this conversation with a talk show host, who, as I said, is an atheist and who believes there was no master plan, let's put it that way. Now, the way this came about, we were talking about this basic subject of whether there was a design plan or not. And so I asked this person, I said, is there a water tower in your town? He said, yes. I said, is it still standing? And he goes, well, yes. I said, well, can you see it? And he said, no. I said, but you believe it's still standing? Well, yes. And did that water tower have a designer? Well, yes. There was someone who designed the water tower and implemented sound engineering processes, and the water tower is standing there, and it will continue to stand there, and you have faith that it will continue to stand there because someone designed it. I said, do you know the designer? Did you watch him design it? Do you know his background? No, he didn't know any of those things. But he had 100% faith that someone designed that water tower, and based on a consistent set of principles, physical principles, and that the water tower was sound, it would stay there. Excuse me. But the fundamental point was that he knew that someone designed that. And then I said, well, how can you look around this amazing universe that is repeatable? Every galaxy follows the same structural properties, whether it's the Andromeda Galaxy right next door, or the billions of galaxies which stretch across the universe. They all follow fundamentally the same principles. So there's some guiding principle in the basic biological makeup of animals or human beings, etc. And so the point is, how could you look at the water tower and know in your mind that there was a designer when you never met him, but then look at the entire universe, which is far more complex and beautiful and repeatable, and not understand that there was a design, a master plan? And that's what transcends all of what we do, science today. And there seems to be some ongoing conflict between science and religion. Like, there should be, some scientists believe that science should answer all questions, and when it does, there would be no more need for religion. And I'm thinking, what a bizarre concept that people are so, would it be arrogant, or would it be self-righteous, or assuming that if you could understand everything going on in the universe, you would eliminate the need for a divine creator. And I find that to be amazing, because it would seem that the more you discover, first of all, just the fact that you have to go out and discover the principles of the universe, and they are not locked in your little brain at birth, that would be an indicator that something was there before you were, or something was there before any of your ancestors in known history were there. All of these principles were still at work, because we're looking at light from galaxies that comes from billions of years ago. So obviously this whole system was at work long before any of us were around, and that would indicate that just the fact that we are able to discover a few principles regarding this wonderful universe, that how can people imagine that that implies that there was no design or master plan? So the concept of repeatability here is essential. Now let's go down to the subatomic world and talk about, something that actually has cosmological implications, and that would be the redshift. When light leaves an object, we can measure this light coming from stars, quasars, and distant galaxies, and it is shifted to the red end of the spectrum. In other words, something causes light to lose energy as it leaves or traverses empty space, and before it gets to us, that light loses a little bit of energy, and so it shifts to the red end of the spectrum. Never shifts to the blue end. You do have objects which are moving towards us, which would give you a blue shift, but in general, as you look around the universe, there is a universality, a commonality, that all the stellar objects, the fusion-based objects, quasars, galactic nuclei, and stars, etc., all appear to be moving away and are redshifted. The light from them is shifted towards the red end of the spectrum, which gave rise to the Big Bang concept. But there are fundamental contradictions. The galaxies which have quasars sitting on our side of them, the quasars are visible with the galaxy behind them, or the strings attaching galaxies and quasars, with the quasars having very large redshifts and the galaxies having lesser redshifts. On and on. There are many contradictions to this idea of the Big Bang. So we have in standard science today the Big Bang, dark energy, dark matter, comets are dirty snowballs, on and on. And these are the fundamental building block principles of science. And now the next step is kind of it's something you see when you're a scientist in this world. It's something that people who buy into the standard science world, its funding, its publication, and honor that rather than truth and repeatability. What happens is when you take inconsistent and incorrect results and try and make those the cornerstone of your science, ultimately you end up with chaotic science, and you have to invent something very bizarre to make everything else work. And that's why I call much of what you see in science today, the dark matter, the black holes, the dark energy, the missing mass in galactic structures, the redshift or the Big Bang cosmology, all of these being band-aids, if you will, or theories which really don't give you a repeatable, consistent theory across the universe. And let me talk about, I was talking about the redshift, so let me go back to that. You can, this is something else that I defined back in my early papers, and my regular listeners know about the concept, the induced electric dipole redshift. It's caused by an electric field emanating from a star or a quasar. The light passing out from the object is redshifted due to what I call the induced electric dipole force on that photon. And this is something that has been verified in the laboratory. I've done the experiments, and they are repeatable. There's that word again. Repeatable. Someone in Russia can do the same experiments. But what's interesting, almost bizarre, is that the scientific community does not want to hear about it. They want to continue with this idea that the redshifts are caused simply by things moving away from us. Despite the fact that you can prove in the laboratory that there is another verifiable, repeatable source of redshift. So, as I said, when science takes the viewpoint that we don't need science, the Galileo type of situation where he's showing by repeatable experiments that you could do, I could do, anybody could do and see the result, and someone keeps teaching the opposite, incorrect science, that's what we're dealing with today. Let me talk about DNA, because that's a very important example of repeatable, on an infinite basis, a repeatable scientific structure. The DNA molecule, or the DNA chain, I should call it, built up of amino acids, and the amino acids ultimately being built up of molecules and ultimately of atoms. There has to be something in nature itself. The fundamental properties of these building blocks goes right down to the atomic level in a repeatable fashion, because if it were not repeatable, we would not look like consistent beings. The you know, 6 billion people on this planet, all based on DNA, would have some serious problems. They simply could not exist without the consistency in DNA. So one then asks, is this the only place in the universe where DNA exists? The answer, based on the simple concept of repeatability, is no. DNA is not unique to this corner, or this planet, or this corner of the universe. It is universal. So any place you find the elements coming together, and these are the basic building blocks that you do see out there. You see the basic atomic structures in outer space, in the most distant galaxies. You know the DNA, whether it's across the street, whether it's in Russia or Greece or China or Pakistan or Malaysia, just like a diamond, if you found it in any of those places, or on the far side of the universe, would be a diamond. It would be formed by similar processes, and it would look very much the same in the subatomic realm, in the crystalline structure that makes up a diamond. Let's take another example. Let's take a non-crystalline structure, amorphous selenium, just as an example off the top of my head. Amorphous means non-crystalline. In other words, the atoms are not in a crystalline bound structure, but more randomly associated, but they are bound together and they still make up a solid piece of selenium. That piece of selenium has many different properties, photovoltaic properties, it has solid state properties, it has many different properties. And the question is, this comes back to the same question as DNA or the galactic structure or the redshift, is a selenium chip manufactured, if you manufactured it on the far side of the universe, would it have the same properties as the selenium chip that I would hold and make and manufacture over here in this part of the United States? Or if someone did it in Russia or China or Malaysia or Greece or Pakistan or India or Italy or France or the North Pole or the South Pole, would that turn out the same? Would you have the same properties for that amorphous selenium chip? And the answer is yes, because of repeatability. If I have the same manufacturing process with controlled margins of error and all of the experimental margins of error controlled, I can reproduce that chip of selenium and it will act the same over here as it does over there or on the far side of the universe. Repeatability is something that is extremely important in science, and as I said, it has been lost in some of the more complex sciences. Now, let's go back to dark matter, this magical matter that supposedly exists out there, which you can't see, but is necessary to make the galactic density wave of theory of galactic structure work. Let's play the devil's advocate once again and imagine that you, in fact, do find dark matter. The properties and the repeatable nature of the properties of dark matter in galaxies is so bizarre that you might be able to model one galaxy to have galactic arms and a density wave, but how does this at random form in all of the galaxies across the universe? And the answer is, it cannot. It will not. And by the simple fact that in celestial mechanics, you have smaller things orbiting bigger things. It's a very simple, repeatable principle. So in the dark matter world, in the dark matter universe, you need far more matter orbiting a smaller galactic nucleus, and it simply does not work. It doesn't work once, and it doesn't work on a repeatable basis. So, once again, even if you find dark matter, it's not going to act in the manner you need it to fix the broken theories, if you understand what I mean. So, the concept of repeatability is lacking in the majority of these major cosmological theories. Let's talk about one more type of example, and this is one that I believe is important because we live on a water planet. So the question, I remember, as I said, 10 years ago, people were saying, oh, could there be another planet like Earth anyplace else in the universe? And if you look out at the vast amount of material in the universe, the gazillions of stars, the countless number of stars, and the fact that they all form by the same repeatable process, yes, there are more water planets like Earth with very similar properties. They probably don't. You would have a hard time finding two with all the exact same properties of diameter and ratio of water to the surface area and the type of atmosphere around the planet or the amount of or the distance from the local star. All of these properties would be very different. And if the more properties you list regarding the planet or the size of the magnetic field, or the energy distribution from the local star. All of these factors, the more factors you list, the less likely of finding a planet exactly like Earth. In fact, if it would be highly doubtful if you'd find a planet exactly like Earth just about any place in the universe with all of the exact same characteristics, and then you include the biological life that exists here, etc. No. I think it would be safe to say there's probably no place exactly like home. But there are many places, billions and billions of planets, which are very similar. Let's put it that way. Some bigger, some smaller, some with higher magnetic fields, some with more moons, some with less, maybe no moons, some with a star that's very weak, some with stars that are very strong, some that are relatively close to the star, some that are relatively far from the star, the central star, etc., on and on. But there are planets that are formed out there and have water-based, probably silicon-based mantle, etc., like ours. Very similar properties, but nothing exactly like Earth. There might be some close twins, but as even with biological twins of little children, etc., they are not exactly the same because of all of the many different variations that can occur. Variations are the key to making the universe work, but repeatability is also one of the keys. So you won't find two galaxies that are exactly alike, even though the processes that form the galaxies are working on the same principles. You won't find two planet Earths exactly the same. So the idea that if scientists look enough and build enough big telescopes, we'll find a planet just like Earth, and we'll be able to take all of our population there because we're destroying this planet. And I think that's the wrong idea. Obviously, we have to take care of the planet, become good stewards of the planet that we live on. But that's a side issue. The idea of repeatability across the universe, whether it's a diamond, a planet, a person, DNA, galactic structure, the redshift, no matter what the scientific principle, repeatability is one of the fundamental properties of the universe that you have to look at and incorporate into your scientific theorizing and analysis of data, etc. Let's look at comets, one of my favorite topics. Obviously, there are going to be comets throughout the universe in various solar systems. How can you have a theory that says comets are dirty snowballs, and you get up right next to one of these so-called dirty snowballs, and there's no snow or ice or anything on the nucleus? There's nothing coming off the nucleus to form this water tail, but it's still called a dirty snowball. You know, these, you know, as I look at science today, as I look at standard science, it's almost as if people are hiding their head in the sand and holding their nose up because of it's actually psychologically disturbing, disturb people in many of these cases when I see people looking at the data that comes back, say, especially from the comet probes, looking at that and still saying, that's a dirty snowball. There's something very wrong with these people, fundamentally wrong, because, once again, the whole concept, the scientific concept of repeatability is not there. If you define a concept, now I could go back, and of course in my own records, I have the decades of theorizing that has come out of the standard scientific community, the drawings of nuclei, the various models, whether it was the composite snowball model or the all of these various, you know, theoretical models of what a comet nucleus should look like. And that's all fine, you know, because people were struggling with basically insufficient data. But once you get out nose to nose with that comet nucleus and you look at it, and it's dry and it's hot and its surface temperature is far too hot to support any kind of water or ice at all, and there is none, and you look at that rocky surface and still call it an ice ball, something is drastically wrong with science. And there again, it's the inability to have repeatable, consistent theories. Now, when I built my model for solar system development based on the capture of comets, it was based on the observation that all of the planets and moons that we see in our solar system are different, which means they came in at different times, they were captured under different circumstances, but all formed by the same repeatable process. That's the key. The process is repeatable, and this is much like DNA, just like the identical twins. The process is the same, but the end result is different because of the many myriad of variations in the formation process. And so that's why the diversity sometimes fools people into thinking that, maybe all of this formed at one time. But the obvious result to me when I looked at this, based on the fact that the process was repeatable, but you look out at the solar system, all of the objects are different. They're different ages. You have the four major moons of Jupiter all looking very different. And how did this happen? Where the smallest inner moon is nearly molten, how did it get there? Is there a process that allows it to come in, be captured, and work its way into the innermost position of the major moons? Yes, there is a process. And that is done through capture. These planets, moons, etc., were all captured at different times. Now, the point here is repeatability across the universe. And this, the reason I'm giving this talk tonight is because it's somewhat of an introduction. It's setting your mindset. It's creating a mindset for people who are about to see my latest book, the one that's coming out in a couple weeks. You have to be somewhat conditioned to see this, because when there are somewhat two groups of people that will be seeing this book for the first time in the upcoming weeks. One will be the average layman who has, some of them have followed my work, other ones listen to the radio show, but they're first going to look at this book and they're going to look at the title and they're going to start reading it and they're going to go, huh? And they're not going to at first understand the significance of this book. But after they get done reading it, they're going to be quite amazed and quite astounded at the repeatability, the simplicity, the many of the other properties that I'm talking about tonight. And the scientists, I think, will have a very interesting reaction, because a lot of trained scientists are going to see this, and it's going to take them, I think it's going to surprise and shock a lot of people. In fact, I know it will, but I'm not going to go into that in great detail. The only point I'm trying to make here is that the talk I'm giving tonight about repeatability and the very fundamental nature of science and discovery and the properties of the universe, the fundamental properties as observable, whether they're here or on the far side of the universe, and the consistency of the universe is a fundamental aspect to conditioning yourself for the release of this upcoming book. And I'm not, once again, I do not release titles or topics as I get ready to release a book. I just announced that it's coming. And for people who, let me just give an example. Every book that I've released has somewhat caught people off guard. I remember the After the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. The people thought that, oh, I was going to just write another volume two of Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, and I wrote the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. In the middle was the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, and then the third book, the third full-length book, is the weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, once again taking everything in about a 90-degree direction from everything that had happened before. The next book coming out is going to go in a completely new direction, a direction that many people do not know this part of my past and background, and that will come out in this book. So I think that's enough said about the new book. Just in a couple weeks, it'll be released. And the last few minutes of this show, I'm going to turn to a topic that's very important today because of there are reports and very disturbing reports that have come in the past day, in fact, that animals, large numbers of animals are dying in certain concentrated populated areas of Earth, especially around a couple cities. And these are not all confirmed reports at this time. I'm going on information that is coming in. It's still somewhat sketchy at this time. But all I'm going to tell you that I know from any other research that I've done is that you need, the most fundamental thing you need in your life is clean water, and it's going to very soon be one of the most difficult things to get. Look around, see what's going on around you. The gravity feed water filter is one that does not hook up to a faucet. It doesn't hook up to any kind of system. There are no batteries or pumps. You simply pour the water in the top. You can pre-filter it if it's very dirty water, like it has a lot of mud in it or something like that. You would pre-filter it through a cloth or something. But basically, you pour water into this water filter. It filters it, and out the bottom comes virus, bacteria-free water. The only thing it leaves in the water, it takes out chemicals. The only thing it leaves in the water are the minerals. And you do need to drink mineralized water. Do not drink demineralized water because it is very bad for you. It, as you drink it, it leaches the minerals out of your body. And so the one filter that I found that it meets all of these qualifications is the Berkey, and with the black Berkey filters. And once again, I'll quick give the 800 number. I don't sell these just because there's something to make money. I don't sell all kinds of other things or flashlights or, you know, there's a lot of things I could sell just to make money, and I don't. But this water filter is something I personally believe that you need. The number is 800-983-5622, or visit my website, jmccsci.com, and learn more about this and some of the other issues that I bring up. Once again, I am out of time, and just be prepared for this book release coming up in a couple weeks. I think I'm very excited about it, and I know a lot of people out there are, well, we'll just wait and see. But once again, I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.